This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to Province Sports Radio. I am Paul Chapman. I'm joined here by Ed Willis. Surviving the weather, surviving the sports world, Ed.
This is the most insane winter. I've been back in Vancouver now. This is my 19th winter since I've been back, and this is by far the craziest. And the funny thing was, just before I came here, looking at what's happening in the Northeast, where the whole seaboard looks like it's going to be paralyzed for the weekend. So, just an crazy, crazy winter.
It really is, and a crazy, crazy sports year. Now, I haven't seen
good
this
segue,
angle.
By the way.
Well, no, but it's funny. But it really has been. Yeah. I haven't seen it written that hockey is the one that hasn't held up its end of the bargain, because I would ask you to say, when was the last truly memorable Stanley Cup Finals? You know, we had the Warriors last spring blowing the 3-1 lead after this epic 73-win season, and LeBron gives Cleveland its long-awaited title. We have the Cubs, obviously, same thing, down 3-1 to Cleveland and coming back and snapping that streak. I've seen people refer to Clemson winning, on the last second, 1 second left, the national championship, underdogs against Alabama, hugely compelling game. And now we have a For the Ages Super Bowl. And this run, this last year, has been beyond remarkable when we look at what we've got in our big sporting events.
Even the subtext to that is not the NFL playoffs were dreadful, but Major League Baseball playoffs were riveting.
Yep.
The basketball play, and I've said this a million times, I mean, the deeper basketball goes, the more interesting the playoffs get. It's exactly the opposite in hockey, where it peaks in the first round and seems to decline from there. So it would be nice if hockey, but it just seems like the most of the excitement in hockey is around the playoff chase and then the first round of the playoffs, and then it settles into this war of attrition, where the deepest, healthiest team with the best goalie and the functioning power play is the team that usually wins the Stanley Cup.
I mean, what would we need to have something that would be a conversation starter the way these other sporting events have been? I mean, one thing I noticed with the Super Bowl, which we'll get to in a second, was how it did draw on the casual fans. So if you're looking for the sports fan to pay attention to a Stanley Cup final, it would obviously need to be a Game 7, probably a Game 7 overtime. You would have need lead changes, but you'd also need star power. And I'm trying
absolutely
to think which matchup would probably give that to you. I don't know, maybe a Chicago and Pittsburgh, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, there's that. It's got to be the storyline. So, God bless them. What if Torts made the Stanley Cup final?
Yeah.
That would be an awesome story. Especially what if this is the year Ovechkin finally makes it, and I think they've got the team around him to do it. But I think that's the kind of thing that would draw in the casual fan. I'm not sure if another San Jose, whoever, Stanley Cup final is going to get it done. But it's so hard to say, because it's a reflection of the game. And I think if you're a student of hockey, you understand why playoffs happen the way they do, but that doesn't extend the game's reach. It doesn't draw in that casual fan. It doesn't become the water cooler conversation piece in the office, unless it's three guys that are crazy about hockey. And it's kind of ever been thus. You asked, what was the last memorable Stanley Cup final? And the first thing that pops into my mind is 1994. Which is crazy. And I know there's been decent ones since, but there was a Detroit Pittsburgh one that went 7 games. There was, help me, in the last couple of years, wasn't
well,
there?
Well, 2000.
The Chicago one with Chicago Philly was decent.
Yeah, but that was a six, it was one in overtime, it was 6 games. You look at 2011 on paper and you say, oh, that might have been a great Stanley Cup final, but it wasn't. Game 7 was absolutely atrocious.
Yeah.
And, a couple of the games the Canucks won that were 1-0 were, it wasn't good hockey. And then you had the blowouts in Boston, which I guess we come to the Super Bowl, what made it memorable? Maybe we need to see a team in Game 7 down what would the equivalent be, 4-0 or 5-0 going into the third period, and just wave of momentum come.
Like the year Boston came back against Toronto, and that, and those are the things.
Yes, exactly.
And it's, I don't know what it is. I'd have to give this a little deeper think, but there's something about football, specifically the Super Bowl, and it's just, I think emotions are so on edge, and they're at such, and when something happens, when something happens to break that momentum, when something happens to distract those emotions, it unleashes these forces. And usually that results in a blowout, like we've seen so many times in years past, where decent teams just like lost their mind and ended up losing like 48-10.
And that's the nature of a one game playoff. I had seen that theory that in the 80s, when you had all these, or 80s and 90s, I guess, you had all these blowouts, is a team will get down by 10 points. And they'd throw their game plan out the window and start throwing 40-yard passes, which ended up in interceptions, and it just snowballed on them. And it's that, you know, if you can have patience in that scenario, which I don't know, that's, you look at how New England did it, but you're 100% right on the momentum thing.
Yeah.
And I think the Leafs Boston is a great example to look at it from a hockey point of view, that once it started to tilt in the second period there, you know, you heard these stories of fans, Toronto fans abandoning the game to make travel plans to go to New York for the next round. Like, there is something about momentum at that.
And I guess the other recent example would be that LA San Jose series, where LA comes back from 3-0. And that is a series that really should have killed that edition of the Sharks franchise. So what they've done, you know, coming back the way they have, is a testament to something. But yeah, like getting back to the Super Bowl, where would you say that ranks? For me, I think there have been better played games, but there's never been a game as dramatic.
No, and in essence, I think the second half in particular, like I've seen this before where, you know, people talked about, I think, the Carolina New England Super Bowl, which the first three quarters of that game were dreadful.
Yeah, and then the fourth quarter was the Mardi Gras.
And that's it. You know, if you look at the game in its totality, I mean, it's definitely a top five, because even if you look at the first half, which was a blowout, you know, you had great plays. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed like every time one of the Atlanta running backs got the ball, they were cracking off at least 30 yards. You had, you know, Julio Jones, who is amazing, because people will remember the sideline catch. He had a number of great catches. He had the lowest amount of targets.
Unbelievable.
I think through the whole year, they said in the championship game, it was just, there's so many talking points out of it.
Right.
And you come back to Belichick and Brady in the end, and they kept their head and they got a couple of breaks.
You know, and that's the beauty of football. There's the post-game forensic. There is so much detail, and you can pour through it. And in that game, you can identify, I'm pretty sure you could count up a dozen occasions where if it breaks the other way, there's no way New England comes back. I mean, we've talked about a lot of them, but the one that never gets brought up, New England had to convert two two-point conversions. Or they're out of it.
Yeah. Didn't it seem far too easy the way they scored both two-point conversions?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course
like if,
it did.
If you don't know football very well, you look at that, you're like, why would anyone ever go for the convert again? Like, just go for two every single time.
No, I know. You're absolutely right. I mean, that, you know, like in an NFL game, that, you know, the spaces are so tight in there. And then they just, you know, they almost walked it in backwards. New England goes for a first down. I think this is in the end of the third quarter drive that leads to the first touch. It's 4th and 3. Is that a coin flip? I don't even think it's 50-50. Nope. I would guess it's made 33% of the time.
Yeah.
No more, no less. If they stop there, the game is over.
We've
been through it, but it's the accumulation of all these that brings this, you know, dramatic narrative to this crazy crescendo at the end, and who's left standing but Belichick and Brady, it seems they usually are. But even then, and you made a great point when we were talking, but before it came on, you take away the Malcolm Butler interception, you take away this game, Tom Brady's record in Super Bowls is 3-4.
And he's tied with Jim Kelly for the most losses in a Super Bowl ever.
Yeah, and it complete it.
But you take away the helmet catch, and he's six and one, so it goes the other way too.
Well, you just so I think the lesson here is we just hope New England makes the Super Bowl, because invariably they're in the most memorable games.
Something about it though, like we will hammer hockey coaches and football coaches for, you know, being super conservative. But then in a case like this, you can see why. I mean, I love the George Allen quote. I don't throw the ball because three things can happen and two of them are bad.
I thought it was Woody Hayes, but that's okay.
Whatever. It was one of those old guys. But, you know, three plays stood out to me all in the fourth quarter. Third and one, they drop back to pass. Strip sack, New England recover,
and that's really the play that starts the whole waterfall.
And then after Julio Jones' sideline catch, three runs, like you're on the 20, three runs you kick, it's an 11-point lead with like 3 minutes to go. There's going to have to be an onside kick in there, and who knows, they probably would have got it considering what was happening, but that would appear to put the game just too far out of reach. Instead, you drop back to pass, get sacked, drop back to pass again, holding penalty. Like, honestly, it is stuff of a script writer. And I think that's beyond your better judgment. You're like, we're going to be aggressive. No, we're going to. If you just hand the ball off three times. And again, the running backs were fantastic.
Yes.
If you just hand the ball off three times, you probably kill the game, but they don't do it.
Averaged almost 7 yards. But it's funny, when I went through them, they gave him the ball twice to start the sequence, and he got stuffed both times.
Yeah.
And I think that spooked. I think that spooked Atlanta, and that's what made them get off it. But this is what blew my mind. So it is second and nine. There is 3:50 left. Okay, so we all know what happened. There was the sack. There was the holding penalty, and then a key play, an incomplete pass.
Yeah.
So 3:50. They ran 20 seconds off the clock. When Brady gets the ball back, there's still 3.5 minutes left. They ran zero time off, which is amazing. So we get back to this thing. Run it into the line, kick the field goal. Yep. There's probably going to be just over 2 minutes left. I believe New England still had one timeout. They might have had another one, but they're going to take it down to the 2 minute warning. 9-point lead. 2 minutes left in the game. I'm sorry, I don't even see Brady coming back from that.
No, and I also saw, I think it was someone from On Deadspin, they didn't actually go back and count the plays, but they sort of did this loose accounting where they said that there were at least 6 or 7 plays where Atlanta snapped the ball in the second half with more than 15 seconds left on the play clock. Well, just add it up. You've got, you know, you got 2 minutes right there, and that's standard football procedure. You know, if you've got a 28-3 lead, you know, who cares if it's a great game? You milk the clock.
That's right.
They didn't do it. They lost the game. And it really is one for the ages. I mean, you do have to give it to Brady Belichick. And I still go about this, Ed. Like, I think I talked about this last week. I look at the Steelers of the 70s, the Cowboys of the 70s, the 49ers of the 80s. Even you go back to the Packers of the 60s. All these teams. Count the Hall of Famers. Yeah, yep. There's at least 4 or 5 on each one.
And Cowboys of the 90s.
Cowboys of the 90s, another one. And again, Gronk didn't play in this game. Like, tell me another team where you would take your second best player, not offensively and defensively, like the whole team, your second best player out of the mix, and they don't miss a beat.
And then they traded away their two best defensive players. And that's their best pass rusher, Chandler Jones.
Yep.
And then they trade Jamie Collins, their best linebacker, in the middle of the season.
I know.
And
for salary cap reasons, because he's asking for too much money.
And I would defy anyone to name three starters on New England's defense. Super Bowl defense, I believe the number one scoring defense in the NFL. I remember Malcolm Butler from the Super Bowl. Is Ninkovich still there?
Yep,
he seems to be around every year. This Dante Hightower cat, he seems to be. But who's the guy who had the strip sack? Was that Hightower? Or was that somebody else? No, somebody else who's never been
Hightower, the holding penalty was forced by Chris Long, which that's a story that was lost in the Super Bowl.
Okay.
What a great story. Howie Long's kid, never even been in a playoff game before. And he was drafted one spot before Matt Ryan in the same draft, but really toiled in complete anonymity
in St. Louis.
Not anonymity because people knew he was a good player, but good player on a perennially awful team. He was saying that was his first playoff game ever, and here it is. He ends up winning such an epic Super Bowl. Is that another great story? But you can't name players on that.
So do you think Atlanta comes back from this, or are we looking at another Seahawks?
You know, again, they've got a ton of talent there, but I don't think it's one of those ones where – you know, when teams have struggled in the playoffs before, and look, the Bengals are nowhere near that category, but being a Bengals fan, you know, they made the playoffs 5 years in a row and it didn't matter. You could have a 15-1 regular season. There's that mentality of, yeah, but when the playoffs come, you can't get it done. And I think that will be an issue with Atlanta. And it won't even be getting in the playoffs. They could get into the playoffs next year, win their first game by 40 points. And that the psyche of losing a Super Bowl that way will always come back to haunt them for those players until they win one. So, you know, yeah, I think for Dan Quinn, is he going to second guess? Is he going to change his game plan? Because, you know, what does Matt Ryan think when he's in that moment? Whether or not they get over it, just the other team, that it takes so much work to get there. Look at what happened to Carolina.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, Carolina was close the year before.
That's right.
But they will have learned from it, and they will come back next year, and they'll be the favorite. They were nowhere near the pace this year.
The NFL is just so competitive, and every year, and it's just there's an element of pixie dust with those teams that, and I don't know if you can replicate those circumstances. Maybe they are. Maybe Atlanta is so supremely talented, and that young defense,
or they do learn
comes
from it
together, and maybe this is the, you know, the one they'll always remember, which is a great hockey thing. You have to lose before you have to learn how to lose, before you learn how to win, etc., etc. I am more in the other camp, though. I just think that might crater that program.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of teams who do that. They get close, and then it just all comes apart for them. You see it in every sport. You know, you could reel off examples. Basketball is probably a little more immune because it really only takes one superstar to change your fortunes. But for the most part, we've seen teams that look like they were on the ascension and they didn't get over the hump. And it'd be fair to look at a team like the Blue Jays, mm-hmm. who have been close, but they mm-hmm. don't look like they're building on it, right? They start going the other way. And then David Price, another example of a guy we've seen who just gets to the playoffs and there's something else happens.
Yep.
And whether that's fair or not, but it's going to linger in your mind until you conquer that. So, go back to Shorthouse's famous quote about them slaying the dragon. But that really was, Chicago was in the Canucks' head. And I think when you have a core of players who've been through something like that, no matter what they tell you, those doubts will creep in. Mm-hmm. And look, good fortune will need to be on your side as well. And in a one-off game like that, you know, you need a break here and there. But like, as great as we talk about Brady, was there a play like we didn't have an Eli Manning moment from Brady? He was incredibly mm-hmm. accurate. You know, he threw the one interception, but and still cool as a cucumber and everything else. And maybe that's Brady's genius. Ed is you look at those 2-point conversions and it just seemed second nature. There was no doubt they were going to get them. And then once they got, and I heard this from all these New England players after the game, once they won the coin toss, they knew they were winning.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
after rolling to that point, you know.
Yeah, we can have a conversation about the overtime rules, but it was, and again, it was just a fascinating, and we can kind of, and that's the beauty of this game is we can come back on it 2 months now, pick up all these points, and they will seem fresh and vibrant. Just because there were so many compelling storylines, so much drama in this, so many turning points, which is ultimately why we watch sports.
Absolutely. So should we talk about the Canucks now?
Well, speaking I think of we have to. We're contractually obligated to. So yes, we are. They're in Columbus tonight, and it seems like this is the must win. This is the game on which their season will hinge. I don't buy that. I think it's pretty well determined.
Hinged?
Yeah, I think that. And honestly, I go back to that game before the All-Star break in Arizona. I think whatever momentum they had, they spend in that game. If they win that one, you can almost make a case, you know, maybe they can just squeeze out enough results on their goaltending and defense to stay relevant. But and having said that, now here's the point I was going to make. I honestly think the best thing for this franchise would be to finish 28th overall again, maybe get a little luck in the draft this time, end up picking in the top two or third or something like that. And then you couple that with the other developments, the emergence of, you know, Stetcher. They've got a defense. They've got, I think on that basis, they could sell this as a successful season, which is a neat trick when you finish 28th overall. But I think everybody is understanding where this team is, what its deficits are, and what it needs to do moving forward.
I saw the point made by a couple of people last week. You may even have been one of them that you know, it's one thing to even with a young team talk about getting into the playoffs and you get on a roll and everything else. But when you looked at the way they played against Minnesota and San Jose, who were two legitimate contenders this year, what good is it getting into the playoffs if you're nothing. That far away from the elite teams?
No, I mean, it would be a rush, and it would be better for the turnstiles if they were playing meaningful games in March and into the first week in April. Absolutely, I get this. But like I said, I just think it kind of, you know, it turned, they were exposed for what they are, and I think people are okay with them finishing as low as they have this year. Yeah, there'll be a lot of, there'll be a lot of snark, and then there'll be a lot of snide commentary. But come back to it, there's only one way out of it, and that's to replenish through the draft. And they have to, I don't know if there's a home run. I doubt if there is. We don't know about Nolan Patrick, who's the number one player in the draft, or the Swedish kid. You talk to everybody, there isn't that generational talent there has been at the top. But another piece of the puzzle, and we'll see.
Nolan Patrick, your standard, you know, that's like Matt's son Naslund. It's such a Swedish name. On that point, though, I love what you just said, that it is building through the draft, because I know Botch wrote a piece today on Lou Eriksson, and you know, at the time, people looked at it and, okay, maybe they were okay with the – or not okay, but maybe it's not outrageous to say $6 million a year, but the term, mm-hmm. 6 years for a guy that age, but that's what you have to pay for to get a player like that on your team. Name one free agent that's worked out. Like, I keep thinking of things like Eriksson, like David Clarkson.
Yeah,
you have to overpay, and they always become an albatross.
You have to save the players or
the owners from themselves in this case.
Yeah. So the best one of the big money and unrestricted free agents is Kyle Okposo, but he was also, I think he was still 26 when he signed. I think he's just 27, and he's on pace for 25 goals. The one real home run in unrestricted free agency was Eric Staal, who was widely viewed to be over the hill, and, you know, his best days are gone, and sure, he's nice. Well, he's a perfect fit on that Minnesota team because they already had two really good centers, so he just fits into the mix, and he's another good player on a team. I really like that Minnesota team. They are just so deep at every position. Looks like they're going to get the goaltending. So they're another team that has to get through Chicago, who's been in their heads the last couple of years. But that's the one. But everybody else, you're absolutely right. Milan Lucic, disappointment. Eriksson, disappointment. You're going to have to help me. Sorry. Andrew Ladd, disappointment.
All of them.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, if you're a New York Rangers or you're Montreal Canadiens and you know you're going to overpay, whether it's at the trade deadline or in free agency, to get a guy in their 30s to maybe put you over the top, fair enough. When your team's like the Leafs, the Oilers, the Canucks, I just think that there's no template where it shows that it really is the draft. And the other thing on that, Ed, is, you know, and again, we have to give Jim Benning, he came in, said his strength was drafting. We're starting to see some of that pick up here. It's not just the first round pick, because I have heard so much about Nolan Patrick being a good player.
Yep.
But there's no great players in this draft. I don't know. I think picking top of the second round and top of the third round, that's where champions are built. I mean, yes, if you look at a team like Chicago, Kane and Taves, obviously, huge help there. But when you look at teams that have also won multiple Stanley Cups, like the Kings, they've got so many guys they picked up in the second, third, fourth rounds who are not just good players, but championship caliber players. Yep. And that's, to me, if your strength is scouting, that's where it should pay off. And I agree with you. 28th or higher, that's where the Canucks really need to be going into this summer, because that is the only way to do it. They do have enough prospects now. You look at the guys in the system that you add with that to with another 1 or 2 years, and you've honestly had enough time to rebuild there.
I think that's fair. I would hedge my bet on that one, because we still don't know what Ylevi is going to be. We don't know what Brock Besser is going to be. It looks great, and they're trending in the right direction, but we'll see. I just scribbled down a couple of other names. The other big free agent signs, and again, they year, Alex Radulov wasn't cheap, but he signed a one-year deal.
Yep.
And the other one is our old friend Michael Grabner, which is just insane what he's done. But again, he moves to a deep team. He's another good player on a team with a lot of good players, comes in without a lot of pressure, and he's just found a little bit of magic this year. But yeah, getting back to the Canucks, it is an interesting one, and I think we've been through this before. I am pretty sure, and there are guys people aren't talking about, like Will Lockwood and Adam Gaudette, Adam Gaudette is emerging as one of the real high-end prospects in this organization. Fifth-round draft pick, and he's having a big, big year. I think it's Northeastern. I hope that's right. But he's over a point a game playing in one of the top college leagues. So, I mean, you know, there's another guy to add to the list. But that, you know, Benning has only been in for two drafts. This will be his third. And, the other point I wanted to make is, I think in connection with Canucks fans, being realistic about where the team is, I think the organization is there now too.
So,
and I think we're going to see a little different shift at this trade deadline.
Okay. How so?
Well, I think you're going to see a Yannick Hansen trade. I think you're going to see an Alex Burrows trade. And I think they're going to go and see if Alex Edler will waive or provide them a list.
I was going to ask you about that just because something you mentioned earlier, that it would be a win for at the turnstiles if the team's playing meaningful games in March. And we know that pressure. We know that pressure is on the front office from the family about playoff revenue or whatever the need for the team to actually make money is. But if I look at this team now, as you said, we're probably already there, but 7 points out, they lose again tonight. They start reaching that 9 or 11 points out, 4 or 5 teams to climb over and not that many games to do it. It will be assumed that the team's not making the playoffs. Do we see Jacob Markstrom play the majority of games? Are there call-ups from Utica? At what point is it not like, oh no, in coach speak, we're going to try and win every game, because Willie's obviously fighting for his job, but can we see a Jordan Subban get 5 or 6 games for you to determine either, yeah, this kid has a future, or maybe someone else wants to give us something for him?
Well,
like trading the vets is one thing, but
that's a great question. And I think the answer to the goaltending depends on what they're going to do with Ryan Miller. If they're going to let him go to unrestricted free agency, then I think we'll see a lot of Markstrom down the stretch when this thing plays out. Subban, I'm not sure about, and a spoiler alert. I talked to Jim Benning this morning before I came in, and I was asking him about Virtanen, which is the column I'm going to write later today. And I asked him, is he going to play in Vancouver this year? And the answer was, and I'm paraphrasing here, probably not. We don't want to disturb what it is he's doing in Utica. He's playing regularly. And unless there's injuries and unless we've got a spot where he can play 12, 15 minutes at the NHL level, he's going to stay in Utica. Now, we can argue about that one until we're blue in the face, but that's what the organization's thoughts are there. So there we have it.
It's curious to
news.
Me.
For, no, it took us no, half an no, hour to get no, to no, it, but we actually
I
got
didn't know
to
if
some
you
news.
Wanted to do the spoiler alert or not, because I can't wait to read the piece, which you haven't even written yet. But the old, we used to call it scooping ourselves, but in a digital first era,
yeah, it doesn't really exist
doesn't
anymore,
matter.
Does it? Yeah.
But that is curious to me. Like, I can see how that's a defensible position, but if you are not making the playoffs and you have NHL games, why can't you give him 12 to 15 minutes in the bigs?
Yeah, I think there's a bigger picture there with Virtanen, and
I think so too.
Yeah, but I think they're trying to send a very strong message there, and loosely stated, they're trying to teach him how to be a pro.
So there's a punishment element to this.
Yeah, I think there is. Yeah, I think there is. There's a little tough love going on there.
Well, that's that's good to.
And they better get it right, though.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
They better get it right, because he represents a lot to this organization. And there's still, you know, they still maintain he's developing. They still maintain he's a power forward, and they develop on a different arc and all those things. And you can give them all that, but there will be a bottom line at the end of it. And like I said, he better develop into something along the lines of a 25-goal top six forward.
Regardless of what you what the assets were spun into, you look at those 2 years, Ed, and it's very recent memory. 4 first round draft picks in 2 years, and you thought, you know what, this could turn the development around in a hurry. If Virtanen doesn't pay out, you know, Virtanen and McCann gone, and Shinkaret gone, you still got Horvat, but and who's a very good piece, obviously, but what could have been, right? And we all, I mean, I love to do the revisionist history of the draft and go back and see who they could have picked. And we're all experts at that point, but man, I'll tell you, whiffing on 3 out of 4 firsts is, and I give them credit for what they've turned them into.
Yeah.
Although we still don't know about Goodbranson.
No, we don't. No, we don't. And yeah, like I said, you know, and then the other part, you know, the other part with Vertanen, and of course, is the players they didn't take who are contributing at the NHL level right now. And the optics aren't good for a rebuilding team. Because if, you know, Vertanen is the player he should be in the lineup now. Nobody's expecting him to be, you know, a 25, 30 goal scorer at this stage of his career. But based on what he did last year, and that was fine for a kid who is still a teenager. He just turned 20 in September. You know, and for him to, you know, get 45 NHL games, and he wasn't a world beater, but he did produce a little bit. And I've still got that one game in Colorado that I was at where he was playing with Berchi and Horvat, and they scored 3 goals.
Right.
Which is also the game Edler and Sutter get hurt.
Right. And everyone said from this point in the team's going to collapse on itself. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. So I've got that memory in my mind, and he's got all the tools, but it's going to be a painstaking process. And, it's as much on the organization as it is on, and I know I've said this a million times, but to me, this is as much on the organization as it is on Jake to get it right.
Man, I love sports cliches, and it just reminds me of what the old Lions defensive lineman Dave Chaters told me about Andre Ware: all the tools, but no toolbox.
Yeah, there you go.
Just, you know, when you look at that, I know we'll never get there just because the feeder system in junior isn't set up for it, but how different would the NHL be if it was like other sports where players came in at 20, 21 and had a full development as an adult, as a young man, rather than leaping into this at 18? And I just wonder how many careers have been ruined because they weren't ready for it. I mean, you only have to look at the Sedins and look at how long it took them to develop. Mm-hmm. There are many teams that would have given up on them 2-3 years before they became elite NHLers. And there's no way around it. I know we have this system where they go back to junior, and then can you place them in the minors? And you're looking at burning years off a contract until there are free agents all come into play. But just the overwhelming evidence to me is that these players would be better off coming in and making that leap at 20 or 21 rather than 18. 19.
Oh, such a delicate dance. And, you know, while we're with cliches, and, I love Ray Ferraro's about that. He's never seen anybody hurt by spending another year in junior or an extra year in the minors, but he's seen a ton of players whose career were ruined when they came up from junior too early, came up from the minors too early.
Yeah. Now, just before we finish, they are playing Columbus. Tortorella, Ed, to me, is just so the story. I don't care what sport it is. I think it's a fascinating story what he's done this year. He was considered yesterday's man when he was hired by the Canucks. So take that disaster out of the way. Somehow someone convinces Columbus that it's a good idea to hire this guy. Everyone's laughing at the fact that the Canucks were able to recoup a second round draft pick out of that. And add to that the disaster that was the USA team in the World Cup of Hockey, and it looked like this was all set for a tire fire. And, and I think it's one of the more astonishing stories in sports.
No, it absolutely
to see what's happened.
Well, it absolutely is, and especially from a Vancouver point of view, to see what he's done. But, you know, it was funny because I was driving in here and I thought this might come up, and I was thinking, and there was an absolutely electric moment towards the end of Tort's stay in Vancouver when the Rangers came in and he was getting the questions about Vigneault and everything. And he stood up there and he went, and this is why I love Tort's. He said, I get it. I'm the idiot because I'm the one with the losing team now. And I understand that. And he went on. And it's so true. And you talk to any coach who's been in one of my absolute all-time favorites, it's Tom McVie, who got stuck with some of the worst teams in NHL history because invariably he would end up trying to coach an expansion team. And it's just like, I got stupid because my players were bad. And invariably that's what it comes down to. I think there's a tweak here, a tweak there, but unless you've got the horses, unless you've got some talent. The other thing is, you know, that Columbus team doesn't, but remember how slow and stultifying the Canucks played that year? That Columbus team is really fun to watch. They fly, they're up and down, the defense is up on the rush. They play a really entertaining style.
Does it work because they are a younger team? I mean, I can see whether it's the Sedins or Burrows or some of these guys, not just like can't be bothered to deal with Torts' bullshit. Whereas, you know, it's comparable to why some coaches work in college, but not the NFL, in that when you have that authoritarian figure, if you've got a bit of a younger team that's looking for some discipline and direction, it works. And that plays to the narrative. You're not a bad coach. You just don't have under you the pieces that necessarily
well,
fit.
I think pretty well all coaches will coach to their talent, will coach to what they have.
Well,
he's got, well, that was
a criticism in Vancouver about whether the Sedins are blocking shots or killing penalties.
Yeah, but they were still a slow old team. Right. Yeah. And you're right. And they did it. What then the style he play, it magnified their weaknesses, if anything. But again, and I've only seen Columbus play a couple of times, including the game here. And what I've seen is a young team that's got like some speed and some skill on virtually every line, like great depth. And which is a common denominator on teams, and also a great push from the back end. And the most underrated rookie to come into the league in the last 5 years, in my opinion, is Zach Werenski. When you have a teenager who can come in and completely change the look and shape of your blue line, that's an incredible find. And that's what that kid has done there. And now you add him to the Jack Johnsons and, you know, the other players they have on their blue line. They might be good for a while. It'll be interesting to see.
And it'll be what will be interesting to see is how far they go in the playoffs, and to tie it back into what we were talking about before, whether that will equal progress. Whether it's true or not, you hear this about coaches like Tortorella's, they have a shelf life that people will tune them out after a while. And so, yeah, they are going to be good for a while. Will that translate, or at some point will they hit a wall? But I'll tell you this. We talked about fun during the playoffs and attention and what you watch. Columbus are a team worth paying attention to in the first round to see which way that goes.
Yeah, and again, and it speaks to like why that first round is so much fun.
Absolutely.
Because of those stories. And I will say, look, this kills me to say it because I would, you know, rather jab sewing needles in my eye than give Gary Bettman credit for anything. But that new playoff system does create some incredible first round matchups. And when you look it down the list, when you might see a Minnesota playing a Chicago in the first round, or you might see a Montreal playing, fill in the blanks. That Metropolitan Division is just loaded.
Yeah,
and it's gonna lend itself to some great first round matchups.
It does, but as we started off talking about great championships, if that leaves you with a Minnesota against Calgary, maybe in a conference final, it ends up being a 4-0 or 4-1, maybe not so good. Like you almost don't want to burn those matchups. But I know what you mean. When there is a big frenzy to watch and see what happens, it certainly does keep it interesting. Anyway, Ed, thank you so much for braving the weather and coming in. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.